Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody here again with us this week. We are really excited about this week's episode. This is one we've been all waiting for to have Robin Murphy on from the Center for Robot Assisted Search and Rescue, and she'll be on in a little bit in just a few minutes here. But before we get talking to her and the rest of our guests, we have to have a chat with my co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, how you doing?
Hi, Jamie. Actually, I've missed you the last few weeks. They won't notice it on the podcast, of course, but you've been busy with some other stuff. And I know you've been
traveling.
That's nothing wrong with that. And I know how excited you guys, this is a guy show. We're talking about cool toys and how they can work in a professional environment. So I know you and Joe are really looking forward to this one. But Joe, it's been a little muggy down there in Memphis, hasn't it?
Oh, that it has, but it's a normal August for Memphis.
Oh, I'm glad I'm here for a change. Well, let's jump into this. We've got Robin Murphy. I can't believe everything that she's done so far, and to consider what still can be done, because robots and drones are still kind of a new thing. So we just see all kinds of possibilities. So, Robin, I'm going to let you tell us about yourself and how you got into this, and then go for it, and we'll throw in some questions as we go.
Sounds great.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I'm a professor of computer science and engineering at Texas A&M, but I kind of been leading a double life since 1995. That was the year of the Kobe earthquake and the Oklahoma City bombing. And so about that time, all the scientists who did artificial intelligence for robotics, we were all working on small robots. We were all thinking we were going to get a piece of what later became the Mars Sojourner mission. You know, small robot on Mars. Well, once you saw the devastation at Kobe and in Oklahoma City, it was obvious that these small robots could have been useful, lightweight, could have gone in some of the voids, could have had two-way communication with the victims, could have really helped out. And it was actually a harder problem than doing stuff, than Mars. So myself in the United States and another professor in Japan, Satoshi Tadakoro, we started changing up and saying, let's do disaster robots. And so that's how it started. And I've been doing disaster robots since 1995.
Wow. That's a long time. I don't think people realize you've been working on these that long. So tell us a little bit about the different kinds of robots we're talking about and where we've used them so far.
Okay, well, Sam, you mentioned two of them. You said ground robots and aerial systems. And I kind of look at the ground and the aerial vehicles as the king and the queen or the prom. They get a lot of attention. But the marine vehicles may actually be the most valuable. Remember, 80% of the population lives by water. And what's the number one disaster worldwide every year? Flooding, either from storm surge or that, right? So you've got critical infrastructure that's been taken out. You've got pollution that you got to trace back. You've got possible swift water rescue. You've got missing, you just name it, you got. So it's not just ground and aerial systems, but marine vehicles that may actually in the long run be the most valuable, because robots assist. They do not replace the experts. They're most valuable when they do things that people and dogs, or in some cases, hummingbirds and hawks and dolphins can't do.
Hummingbirds. I have never thought of using a hummingbird on a disaster, but is it true that the first use of these was Hurricane Katrina?
The first use of small unmanned aerial vehicles was, in fact, Hurricane Katrina. Quasar was first up with that. We beat, I think the Army had some Silver Foxes out. We beat them by 2 or 3 days. We were working at that time as part of the state of Florida. We were working in Mississippi. We'd been called in to assist with New Orleans by the Louisiana teams, could not get there by the time we had driven over from Florida. That had been cordoned off, and the situation was rapidly becoming unsafe. So we fell back and worked in Mississippi. So that was the first use of ground robots. The first use was actually the World Trade Center, 9/11.
Really? Tell us about that.
Well, that was one of the ones that, that stays with all of us, doesn't it? It really
yes, it does.
really started a lot of research themes for us. We had been working with Florida Task Force 3 since 1999, and the DARPA robotics program at that time, the Tactical Mobile Robotics Program, was focusing on what later became those Hurt Locker style of IED robots. Again, trying to make them smaller, the kinds of things that would have been great at Oklahoma City bombing or the Khobar tower bombings. So here it comes. There it is. And we get called up by New York to go up and help. So the head of CRASAR at the time, Lieutenant Colonel John Blitch, a former grad student of mine, pulled together people. We came up there, and it was all ground robots. At that time, UAVs, small UAVs, didn't exist. The technology wouldn't really become viable until 2005, 2004, you really started seeing it there. But anyway, so you're talking about small ground robots, things that could go deep in the rubble. And of course, as you know, you can, existing techniques are pretty good for 20 feet. But of course, at the World Trade Center, you're looking at 60 to 300 feet in the rubble to see if you could get down to the basements or find where the stairwells actually wound up at. Or the shortcuts. So they use the small robots that could only get in between those box beams. Believe it or not, you're going in the center of the box beams, using those kind of like as a soda straw sticking out of the rubble, and see if you could find a shortcut into to the center of the rubble. So we were there for 2 weeks. And then other team members stayed there for another month until the last robot broke.
Well, given as I was one of those people taking care of all of the injuries of folks on the pile, for a couple weeks myself, the thing that really sticks out to me is how much better safety and how fewer injuries this may cause to responders by having something like this.
You know, I think it may, but we look at robots as actually being assistants, not replacing the experts. The best use of robots is historically, I mean, this is includes manufacturing, is to do things that people can't do well. Or just can't do it all. So an aerial system, UAVs are taking off because not only can you now get a plane that you couldn't get, the Civil Air Patrol couldn't fly, or the manned helicopter asset, it's not that it wasn't expensive, they couldn't fly that low, or they couldn't fly right the moment you needed them, that you had to do a go, no-go decision. Same thing with the ground robots. You know, there's spaces, as you know, World Trade Center, it was a pancake collapse. There was no space for a dog or person. If there was space for a robot rat, which some of those people, we can, chip up a rat and drive him in. I was like, yeah, the part about it being on fire and voids, areas, layers that might not have had oxygen, that was going to be a problem. So robots are really there not to replace anyone, but to be another tool in the toolkit.
Yeah. What I was thinking specifically, just here's a scenario, is one day I actually had to go out on the pile with a partner of mine with ALS gear because they were doing a caving operation. They were digging into an area they wanted to go, and it was dangerous because the ceiling was quite tentative, and that's why we were out there, just in case. But I'm thinking in terms of if there was a robot that could go into some of these areas to determine if there was even any reason for them to dig there, that could be a big, it could save them a lot of time and energy and possibly some injuries. I'm going to throw this to Joe because I know he's probably burning up over there with the questions relating to you, sir.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating stuff. One of the things I'd love to talk about is sort of the evolution of robot assistance from how they move differently. In other words, what have we learned from early deployments in Katrina and Trade Center, and how have we modified robots to make them more more functional? And also like to talk a little bit about the additional add-ons of two-way functionality. In other words, not just going in and looking around, but actually being able to do something for the person who's trapped there.
You know, Joe, that was the biggest difference, I think, that came out from the very first robots. We have always used surveying robots, hardened robots. We need them to be waterproof. We need them to be reliable. As you well know, a disaster is not the time, when you want to bring out something that you've never tried before. And, I love my grad students, but I don't know if you want computer scientists to try to build anything that you were hoping to hold together. So the biggest thing that we saw in the ground robots is exactly the two-way audio, the two-way video. Instead of looking at this as a camera on wheels, a track that can, you know, rappel down and can pull itself through the rubble, now we're seeing people realizing, wait a minute, it's not just seeing, I need to interact with victims. I need to interact with the handler who's putting me in the hole. I need to listen for things. I need to hear if my wheels are spinning or my tracks are spinning. I need to actually now begin to interact with the environment. Poke at it. Is that red thing part of a, you know, is that just a piece of a FedEx wrapper or is that something else? You know, how do I sample? How do I interact? So that two-way interaction and the physical interaction is probably the biggest thing you've seen on the ground robots. They still look the same. They still look like miniature tanks. There's just something about tanks with those tracks and being able to get kind of a running angle that you saw from the World War II tanks that still works for us. The UAVs, smaller, lighter. Of course, the big change we saw from Katrina, we ran at Katrina both fixed wings and we ran rotorcraft, things that look like helicopters. Fixed wings still look like fixed wings, miniature airplanes, but the rotorcraft now look like quad rotors, right? They no longer, you don't see things that look like regular helicopters. You see these balanced 4 and 8 and sometimes 3 rotorcraft that give much more flexibility, much more stability, easier to control. So that's probably the biggest difference. The UAVs look a little different. And the marine vehicles, they look the same. They look like boats. You're getting a little smaller airboats now. What's happening is underneath them were all those great sonars. Those are changing as they're making huge advances in the sonars. And then all of them are changing because it's not the robot, it's the data. And now everybody's beginning to realize, ooh, holy cow, we got all this data. Reading an sonar of a bridge is a lot like reading an ultrasound of a baby, which is sort of like, is it a boy or a girl? I don't know. So you've got to get much accurate. You've got to get better image processing, more computer vision, more artificial intelligence to help out.
So, Joe, can you think of a situation where on a USAR event, something of what she's talking about would have been really useful?
Oh, I think everything she's talking about, these are game changers in many ways. The idea that I could remotely assess and interact with a patient via video and audio, the idea that I could potentially even put something on that robot to have it carry it through an inaccessible to human passageway and deliver that patient some medical-related issue, just food and water. Maybe I could do nothing more than just drag a hose to them so that I could get water flowing to them. And that sort of stuff. They're just game changers on every level.
Yeah, Joe, we've looked at that. I mean, starting with the Turkey earthquake, if you just start looking at taking a small hose with a goldfish pond level pump to get water down there, but also air just to cool off, to be able to start knocking some of that dust down if you're trapped in a void. And of course, thinking of all the things, I know California teams are really good. They've got like their little response gear that's about the size of a Pringles can that they can shove down to people. That's exactly the sort of thing a small little robot can carry down there. But also the cool thing is that robot's going to be your buddy. And so we've done a lot of research with Stanford on how people react to having a robot around them while they're trapped and they've got mobility. And so imagine you've now got the ability, even if you've got two-way audio, the eardrums may be blown out. They may not speak English, but you can pop up little cards, have the robot display those kind of universal communication cards to indicate where does it hurt, what are they doing, kind of work through that. It's a whole wide world that I think is going to be opened up now.
That's fascinating. And just a trapped person knowing that somebody knows they're there. I mean, just on that simple a level. Jamie, you got to have some thoughts behind some of this.
Well, I was just thinking of our earlier episodes where we've talked about this, and I think I have a question for Robin about, you know, the one situation we talked about, Jim talked about a flood situation around the Memphis area where a citizen came up with a quadcopter and offered to use it to search downstream for some teenagers that they suspected were missing. They weren't using, and this was a civilian who came and volunteered to show them, you know, the downstream camera view from above, for, you know, a couple hundred yards or something like that. And, this was something that they, that was brand new, but it ultimately ended up being a very useful tool. Do you see this as something that's going to become part of a disaster response teams or a given emergency operations center's kit of supplies rather than a deployable asset like what you have now?
Oh, absolutely. And it would be horrible to think that people were depending on groups such as ours to supply these robots. These should be in the hands of all the fire rescue departments and law enforcement. They're just really useful. That flooding, so what we get into with the flooding, that raises some really interesting questions, right? Because it's already been used for flooding. Here at the Texas floods, we've used them for that, mudslides, both in Colorado and the Oso mudslide. But when we start looking at missing persons, it turns out people, it's just not popping a camera up there. Video, what we're finding, we're going back and running controlled studies, but what we're finding is video is not very good. You're not seeing a lot. It's not even high resolution. The mind doesn't process all those little bits of color or that little something of debris that indicates that could be somebody there. So part of the problem is you need to be flying high resolution still imagery cameras. You want to fly at, you know, so, and that's hard for people to look at. You got to have a geotag because people are going to look at those and have to go over with the fine-tooth comb those high-resolution images. So if they're going to find anything, so now you've got to know where to go back to. And likewise, if you've got a river bluff or something, flying directly overhead, which is a lot of times what you do with your fixed wings, won't give you those oblique angles. So we've kind of developed a chart that says if you've got this situation, you probably want to use this type of rotorcraft. If you want to do this, you probably want to use a fixed wing. If you're doing this, you might want to do this. If you're doing floods or missing persons, you probably want to think about these types of things. And then we have students who are working on building computer vision algorithms to look for any, what they call spectral anomalies, anything that doesn't look like a tree or a piece of mud, and pull that on up for somebody to be sure and look at so they don't miss anybody or miss any signs.
It's using the technology to supplement the human eye. And so the computer algorithm can then go in there and say, this piece, this set of pixels doesn't look like the rest of the pixels around it. It might be something to worth more examination.
That's right. So now you've got a system that can at least pull out, you know, if you can pull out 70% and do that in a couple of minutes, I mean, what we were seeing when we flew at the Texas floods with the Lone Star UAS Center's team, as part of them, Texas A&M, one large state and a lot of groups working together, what we saw is that 20 minutes of flight, you're getting close to 800 high-resolution images with a couple of gigs of data. Right? So people just can't go through that fast or reliably. So the more that we can make the computer smarter and take advantage of that, that's the way to go. So our job, we look at it as these things become more mainstream, keep learning and try to keep the next thing in the pipeline to be helpful to the real responders and the professionals such as yourself.
One more question. I realize we don't have a whole lot of time, Robin. I wish we did. But again, we're going to have you back. You sent us a huge volume of great information specifically on guidelines. And you may or may not be aware of, you know, of course, you know, most of Northern California is on fire. But in one of those situations, the fire jumped a major highway and the firefighting apparatus actually were unable to hit it the way they wanted to because there was somebody's drone in the way of that. And I don't know all the particulars outside of that, but as more and more men on the street, women on the street get these things and want to use them for their own enjoyment of a disaster, I kind of see that as a problem. And almost to the extent where I'm visualizing, just like with aircraft, there needs to be some guidelines on who and when and how you can fly in a disaster area, especially when there's danger to people involved in firefighting troops. What do you think about that?
Sam, it's so frustrating. There are rules. Yet people are just not paying attention to them. I mean, it's like a gun. If you have a gun, you can legally own a gun. You can go to the pistol range and use, you can get carry permit. Can you just show up and help the police because they've got a shootout going on? Of course not. And I don't know why people think just because you got a UAV, you can help out the you know, Cal Fire. It's like, no, and they don't understand. I mean, we got into a dangerous situation out at the Ozone Mudslides. So here is, you know, you're talking about doing tactical helicopter rescue, right? You're at 200 feet or less. They are so low, they are beginning to kick up mud to the bottom of that of the helicopters that they're using to transport out survivors. And they've got the possibility that all that wood will come up through those rotors that could kill them and the helicopter who have fallen survivors. And here comes some guy with his UAV, his little, you know, DJI Phantom. And say, well, I can fly because I'm under hobbyist rules. It's like there's a frigging TFR. A TFR, temporary flight restriction, is the equivalent of cordoning off the highway. And, you know, what you don't know can kill somebody. So that's a big deal. You can tell I care a lot because it's so important to not have a rule come down that kills UAVs for everybody. It's such an important tool. And we worked with Texas on House Bill 912 to make sure that law enforcement, fire rescue, all forms of emergency management would be able to use it. But, you know, everybody's got to cooperate here. Use a little common sense.
Well, I hit a hot button, and I'm glad I did, because I think it's really an important point. So if you buy a gun, you're going to be required to know how to use it, we hope. And there's that, be aware of certain guidelines and rules around it. If somebody goes out and buys one of these things, is anybody going to tell them what the rules are? How do they get that information and become responsible for it?
Yeah, there's all sorts of, now when you buy them, they have the little website, you know before you fly, that's supposed to tell you into the rules, things like that. Also, the thing that we had hoped that has not really panned out, people don't realize that their homeowner's insurance don't cover most problems that you would have at the UAV. So you take your UAV and you whack somebody's windshield on the neighbor's car, not necessarily covered. If you interfere with air traffic control at Kennedy International Airport, that they come with you with guns for those kinds of things. So it's interesting to, you know, and how would you even think about whether your homeowner's insurance could pay for screwing up air traffic? So that's one of the things that we're just still not having the word out yet.
Yeah, and that's my biggest concern, is that somebody is really going to get injured or compromised because some hobbyist is out there thinking he knows what he's doing. And, wow. So, Joe, can you visualize some of these UAVs out there playing with you on one of your larger Paragon training events?
Oh, I think that'd be a great addition. You know, I think one thing that'd be really fascinating is with the addition of a widened sensory perception, I'm thinking infrared and all that sort of stuff, the ability to assess a patient, not only to find somebody, but then to potentially be able to assess somebody as to whether or not they might be hypothermic. Maybe they've got a limb that's cold due to obstruction or tourniqueting effect or a clot or whatever. You know, all of those things are yet to come in our quest to figure out how best to use these things. And that, of course, as the technology improves, to give us better and better resolution.
Well, Joe, let us know. I mean, we're always trying to learn from the real users so that we can, as scientists, keep supporting y'all's important mission. So that's great to know.
Well, Joe's group, Joe is, you know, with Tennessee Task Force One, but he's also one of the principals in a company that does disaster preparedness training around the country. And Paragon Medical Education Group actually is one of our sponsors here on the show. So that would be something that I think would be very interesting for them to take into a jurisdiction and say, here are some of the possibilities that you could have available when you have a situation, a disaster of any sort hit your community. And Joe, I could see a lot of potential. You know, we haven't even we've just barely scratched the surface here in this episode.
Oh, absolutely. There's so many more things to talk about and so many ideas on these things. I think the sky's the limit, no pun intended.
And in a matter of speaking, yes. So, yeah, there's possibility. And I'm thinking in terms of, like, we're trying to teach firefighters how to work with cops in an active shooter situation. This is something new that I could very well see a USAR or a disaster group scenario, many of which you've been doing, Joe, just saying, how do we interact with these things? What do we do? What do we not do? I think there's some huge potential out there.
Definitely.
No, I agree completely.
So why don't you, let's see, Joe, why don't you tell us where folks can find you guys at Paragon in case they want to have you come in and do some specific training or specific evolutions in your experiential training format?
Sure. Well, Paragon is on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com and on Facebook under the same name. And you can find our Twitter feed at ParagonMedEDU. And you can also reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
Great. And Robin, how about you? Where can folks find out more about this? I know you have lots of resources and some web resources and things like that. So tell us a little bit about where folks can find out more about robot-assisted search and rescue.
Well, on the web, we're at CRASAR.org, which is CRASAR, Center for Robot-Assisted Search and Rescue. And I have a book out that came out last year, Disaster Robotics, that covers 34 disasters worldwide where robots have been used at, ground, aerial, and marine vehicles, what they were used for, what was working, what kind of wasn't working, and some of the lessons we learned about field experiments and what data to collect and how to start the crew organization, those sorts of things. So those are probably the two spots. But if you do Robin Murphy Disaster Robots, it usually comes up to me. Every now and then you'll get the satanic killer who broke parole up in Vermont. But most of the time it'll come up with me. I'm not the killer on parole.
Well, that's good to know. I will have links to that in the show notes over at disasterpodcast.com, both to your book. So if people want to just go ahead and get it, they can grab it through the link there, or and also to CRASAR.org so that they can follow up there. And again, thank you so much for being on the show this evening. It's I hope that you enjoyed yourself and are interested in coming back, because I think we could probably talk about this a whole lot more.
I know you were having trouble getting me to shut up. Sorry. I just love talking about it. It's so important. I think it's such a great tool for y'all.
Great.
Thanks so much for having me here. Yep. It really means a lot to get the word out.
Thank you. And Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, first I have to say, Robin, we appreciate your passion for what it is you do and just what it is you do, because I think you're going to be a huge asset to the disaster world. I'm found in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, or certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. And we have to get some questions on this, Jamie. I mean, this is such a new field and it's such an interesting field. And like I said, the potential is unlimited. So if you have a question, pop it up there. And I'm sure we could coerce Robin into coming over and giving an answer to those questions for you.
Yeah, definitely. We want people to head over to disasterpodcast.com, find this episode over there, and just leave a comment right there on the page for this episode. And we'll go ahead. When you leave a comment, it shoots me an email, and I'll be able to go over there and respond back. And I'll shoot Robin an email and point her to the link, and she can take a look at the question if it's something that she can answer, or she can email me back an answer, and I'll put it up there myself. But either way, we will get your questions answered, and we want you to talk to us. What do you want to hear more about with robot-assisted search and rescue, so we can have Robin back on a future episode and maybe have some audience questions to pose? So we hope you'll do that. So head over and check out everything, myself and Sam and Joe and everybody else over at disasterpodcast.com. And, you know, Sam, we were talking about the medical applications of these robots in these situations. Joe mentioned it. Robin mentioned it. You and I talked about it some. I mean, it really is bringing a whole new aspect to anything we've ever talked about regarding disaster medicine.
Yeah, and in a year and a half we've been doing this, we assume we've covered it all, and like you said, I don't think we've grasped the surface, but it's abundantly clear that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.